What's it like reading Pride and Prejudice in its entirety aloud? Rosamund Pike will join us to talk about her experience recording a new audio edition of the Jane Austen classic.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
Now that more books by last year's Nobel Prize winner Patrick Modiano have been translated into English, which one should you read? Kayama Glover, who reviews 7 of those books in this week's issue, will be here to discuss.
And that's, you know, I call it in the review, the gritted teethness of his novels, is that the prose tells you what it seems he needs to get out.
What was Shakespeare's world like in 1606? James Shapiro will be here to talk about his new book, The Year of Lear.
I'm convinced that if you understand writers responding to the pressures of that time, you can appreciate the works a bit more.
Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world. John Williams will share our readers and listeners' favorite books of 2015. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
Is he married or single?
Oh, single, my dear, to be sure. A single man of large fortune, 4,000 or 5,000 a year. What a fine thing for our girls.
How so? How can it affect them?
My dear Mr. Bennet,
replied his wife,
how can you be so tiresome? You must know that I'm thinking of his marrying one of them.
Rosamund Pike joins us now from London to talk about a new project, not a movie. Rosamund, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
You've recorded Pride and Prejudice, the audiobook version, coming out this week. How did you get involved in the project?
Well, it's one of these things that an actor gets periodically is the offer to do an audiobook. And at the same time as it being very appealing, you sort of take a deep breath, because the one thing that's for certain about an audiobook is that it's a huge amount of work. But as someone who grew up alleviating the boredom of long car journeys by listening to books on tape, I suppose it's a sort of way of giving back for all those hours of pleasure that I had as a child.
You've just revealed yourself of a certain period by calling it books on tape, which is also what I also call it.
Exactly.
What did you like about listening to books on tape? What appeals to you about them?
Well, it's a very involved experience, because I really believe that you take in a book in as much depth as you do when reading it yourself. You know, unlike a film, which obviously provides you with images and faces, it's still up to you when listening to a book to picture everything for yourself. Although, you know, if it's well read, there'll be quite descriptive characterization through the voices. I just feel that the books that I listened to on audiobook format remain some of the most vivid in my memory.
What are some of those books that you listened to?
Well, they were Hardy novels. I mean, I did a lot of classics, actually. Hart, Thomas Hardy, Tessa d'Urbervilles, George Eliot, Adam Bede. I mean, you know, quite weighty things. You know, things that would be daunting for a young person maybe to read, but to listen to feels much more possible. But, you know, there is so much more available now. I mean,
right.
When I was a child, it was mostly the classics that were being done.
Was Pride and Prejudice something that you felt particularly strongly about as a reader?
No, not before particularly. I mean, I wasn't really a girly girl growing up. I didn't, you know, I think when books really excited me at a younger age, it was often American novels. I mean, On the Road, I remember just sort of blitzing my brain when I read that, and Harper Lee and Carson McCullers, and, you know, that it was American voices that spoke to me, that seemed to have that, well, to an English girl, the sort of otherness and the excitement of sort of flavors and worlds I wanted to taste. But encountering Pride and Prejudice again this way, obviously I did the film, but doing it this way, I mean, I just marveled really at the brilliance of it. It's so good. It's such a good book, and the characters are so vivid and rich and real, and her knack for dialogue is what makes it such a joy to read aloud.
You were in the movie as Jane in 2005, and, you know, that's now 10 years ago. In the intervening years, did your reaction to rereading the novel, did it change?
Yeah, I think your understanding of sort of how something is being done increases as you get older, I suppose. I suppose because I was reading the book back then for Jane, it was only now in reading this book that I sort of fully appreciated the sheer brilliance of Elizabeth Bennet as a character. know, because I got to, obviously, in reading the book, speak her dialogue and play out those scenes with Mr. Darcy. And, you know, she's an extraordinary heroine. I mean, she's exactly the kind of girl that, you know, young girls today need. You know, she doesn't conform to any models of how one should behave. You know, she behaves with completely true unto herself and sort of smiles at the pettiness of certain conventions, which I think, you know, if girls nowadays had as healthy a attitude to, I don't know, not conforming, it would be a good thing.
When you were performing the role, reading this aloud, how did you handle the different characters? There's so many different approaches. Some narrators will just deliver it all in one voice. One will create voices for each of the different characters. It'll seem like they're really acting out those roles, whereas others, it feels more like they're reading them. How did you handle that?
I just go with my instinct, and my instinct is how it sounds in my head. So all the characters do have their own particular voices. It's to do with rhythm, it's to do with tone, it's to do with affectation, little tics, all those things that interest me about the human voice. I mean, I'm a kind of voice catcher, really. I love the way people speak. I'm always listening for tiny, tiny things that set people apart and, you know, the tells that people have. I mean, I catch voices I hear overhear all the time on my iPhone. I'm always collecting sounds. And that's how I do, you know, when I'm working on a book, I'll be listening all the time with an extra keen ear. And if I like something, I'll steal it. I'll borrow somebody's pitch, or I'll borrow somebody's, the way somebody drives towards the end of their sentences, or the way they, you know, behave rather girlishly, or an affect of a drawl, or anything. And with this, the characters are so vivid, I really do want to bring them alive. So yes, I play them all. I play all the characters.
You mentioned that.
Hopefully not in an irritating way. I mean, that's,
actually, that brings up an interesting point, because I think that anyone who's listened to books on tape or audiobooks or whatever we want to call them has their sort of pet peeves of audio readers. And you mentioned that you'd grown up listening to them. Are there certain things that you thought, when I do this, when I narrate an audiobook, I'm not going to do that?
I don't want it to be declamatory. I just want it to be natural. I want to find the voice of the narrator, first of all. You know, I want to feel that the person I'm listening to is totally comfortable in that voice of the narrator. So, you know, for me, you know, Austin's English is not our modern English. The sentences are longer, the thoughts are more elaborate. But I didn't want it to appear stilted. I wanted that to appear just with the freshness of original spontaneous thought. So, you know, you work on those sentences. You just work on being able to carry the thought over those phrases and make it sound like, you know, you're just talking like you and I are now. So, yes, I don't want to be shouted at. I don't feel I want to be controlled. I want someone to invite me in. I want someone to just, it to feel like I'm talking to somebody who has the warmth and wit that I enjoy speaking to or speaking with. I think you want your narrator's voice certainly to have no ticks, you know, all the things I talk about in terms of characters and finding little differentiations for characters. You want your narrator's voice to be as, you know, even and untricksy as possible.
You mentioned up front that doing an audiobook is a huge amount of work. Is part of that because you have to find and create all of those different characters and voices?
I mean, I do. No, I don't know that everybody does, but it's how I like to do it. It is an honor to do it and to get to play all these characters, but you have to work through the script, highlighting bits. I have a sort of whole phraseology, or like, it's like musical notation, the way I mark up my script, so that I know, you know, I know what's coming at the bottom of the page. I'll write sort of keys that'll tell me where I'm going, because it's not just about the sentence you've got in hand. If you're going to get the tone right, you've got to know where you're going, right? You know, when the end of the chapter's coming, when the more dramatic passages are coming, when you've got the light, I mean, witty stuff. I mean, she's so funny, Jane Austen. You've got to have you've got to know what's coming in order to get the timing right.
I would imagine in conversation, especially doing all of those different roles, and when there's all that repartee, to switch gears constantly, that must be especially challenging.
It's funny, you know, because as an actor, I never stumble on the dialogue. When I stumble and have to go back, it's always on the narration, which must be something about, I don't know. It must be because dialogue is what I do, you know.
I would imagine also that is it a challenge to have everything come down to the voice, because they're not seeing your facial expression, they're not seeing gesture, they're not seeing movement, that everything has to be conveyed through the voice alone?
I love that. I mean, I think I do genuinely believe that listening gives different insights. I mean, if you ever, I don't know if you find it, but if I ever listen to a program on the radio or a talk show when I'm driving or anything like that, the information, it's absorbed into your brain in a different way from things that you've read. There's a vivid immediacy to it. I love it, and I believe in it.
This novel has been interpreted and reinterpreted both in texts and in film and also in audio versions. Was it hard to kind of get all of that out of your head and make it your own?
I didn't rewatch any of the films. I mean, come on, it's a gift, isn't it? It's like you get to, you know, play your entire cast of characters. It is like being a child and getting to, you know, play everybody with your puppet theatre. But, you know, it is hard, and as it is stressful as it approaches the time you're doing it, and you haven't, you know, quite, you know, you're still thinking, is Mrs. Bennet going to sound like this or like this, and how are they going to relate, and is there a kind of connection between all these sisters, you know, because they've got to sound like, you've got to have different voices for the five sisters, but they've got to sound like they're from the same family. And there are a lot of women in Pride and Prejudice, so finding, you know, and you don't want to make anyone absurd, they've all got to be real.
Right.
You know, that's my other thing, actually. That's the other thing I really don't want, is I don't want caricature. I never liked books where I felt that characters were being caricatured.
Right. Well, I think you also find in certain audio that, and I won't name names of books, but where an actor will find a voice that they just love, but it does verge into caricature, and to listen to it, you know, for long periods of time becomes incredibly tiring for the listener.
I agree.
Well, you didn't do that in this.
I suppose the only person I slightly had in mind, I suppose if I was Donald Sutherland's Mr. Bennet. I did sort of love Donald as our father, and I suppose at the back of my mind always I definitely had Donald in my head.
If you want to hear Rosamund Pike channeling Donald Sutherland as Mr. Bennet, we can listen to the audio version that you've just recorded of Pride and Prejudice. Rosamund, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Well, I hope people enjoy it. And please feel free to write to me and complain if you don't.
And that was Rosamund Pike, who will be narrating Pride and Prejudice out this week from Audible. Alexander Alter is here now to talk about what's going on in the literary world, but I don't know if literary is the right word this week. Alexandra, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me. So I think our listeners have heard about a little movie that's coming out on December 18th. It's the next installation of Star Wars, and fans of the original series have been waiting for decades for this, but some of them haven't been waiting for the story to continue. As some of our listeners probably know, there have been more than 150 Star Wars novels. The first one was published in 1977. George Lucas was listed as the author.
Listed as the author. That's very diplomatic phrasing there, Alexandra.
It was actually ghostwritten by Alan Dean Foster. It's an interesting sort of universe of books that are incredibly popular, and they're an important part of the franchise. And of course, as you can imagine, with this big movie event, Star Wars books publishers have been cranking out some tie-in books and starting the marketing blitz early. There are apparently around 20 Star Wars books coming out this fall. Some of them are meant to kind of introduce readers to sort of catch them up on what's happened.
Get them primed.
Exactly.
It's funny because when I was a teenager, I loved novelizations of movies. I almost think that, like, before DVD players and even video cassette players, it was a way to kind of keep the movie with you.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I think, you know, before you could download things and watch them instantly, this was a way to keep fans engaged and to sort of re-experience the movie. But sometimes these novelizations go beyond just you know, recreating the plot in print, they actually extend the story. And this has become something of a sticky point with really hardcore fans of the Star Wars books because...
Chewbacca didn't say that. Is it that kind of thing?
It's actually much worse than that. In the novelizations, which they refer to as the extended universe, Chewbacca meets an untimely death. Of course, that doesn't happen in the movie version that's coming up, as we've seen in the previews. So the fact that the movie is departing from the novels is a big sort of sticking point with some hardcore fans of these Star Wars novels who've been reading them for decades and who feel committed to the storyline and think, you know what, if J.J. Abrams is going to bring us back to this world, he should be committed to the original vision. And
they want total consistency.
Exactly. Whereas we're seeing kind of an alternate universe. Of course, you know, it being science fiction and fantasy, I think we can allow for that. So the amazing thing is it's a tiny part of the Star Wars overall franchise, which has been estimated to be something like $37 billion.
You mean lightsabers do better than the novelizations?
I imagine they do. But however, within publishing, these are incredibly popular books. I mean, they're, you know, with the 150 Star Wars titles that Del Rey has published, I think they have sold something like 70 million copies together with their sister imprint, Bantam. So, I mean, that's pretty significant if you look at, for publishers, the kind of money that they're making.
It's not just, there are a lot of publishers of sort of Star Wars related books, right?
Yes, it's spread across several imprints, and there is a sort of Star Wars specific imprint, and then a few different fantasy imprints. There's a children's line, there's comics, there's almost anything you can imagine, including, you know, spoofs like Shakespeare's version of Star Wars.
So. Are you going to weigh in here critically, Alexandra, with what you think is the best Star Wars book out there?
I'm pausing because I've only read one, and it was actually pretty great.
All right. Tell us what it was.
It was Troy Denning's Crucible, and what was compelling to me about it was, you know, I watched Star Wars when I was a kid, the originals, and in the 80s, and I loved them. And I hadn't realized until I was doing this publishing story that the story had continued. So here was, you know, Han Solo, Princess Leia, all in their 70s, you know, grandparents and continuing on. And I hadn't realized that they had aged and lived and done all these things. So it was exciting to sort of catch up. Although now I think when I go to see the movie, it might be an entirely different set of circumstances.
They live forever, Alexandra.
That's true.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks.
Kiama Glover joins us now. She teaches Francophone literature at Barnard, and this week she reviews 7 books by Patrick Modiano. Kiama, welcome, and thank you for doing that.
It was my great pleasure, actually, and thank you for having me.
So there was a rush to, I think, translate into English and bring out editions in America after Modiano was named the Nobel Prize winner last year of literature. Now they're doing it for Svetlana. I think they're forcing literature on translation onto global readers, which is great. Let's go quickly down the names of the books that you reviewed this week, starting with nonfiction, Pedigree, a memoir by Patrick Modiano, obviously. His what's now called the Occupation Trilogy, which includes 3 novels, La Place de l'Étoile, his first novel, The Night Watch and Ring Roads, After the Circus, Paris Nocturne, and his most recent novel, So You Don't Get Lost in the Neighborhood. You read all 7 of these books while traveling in France and Germany very aptly. What was that experience like?
Well, it was a pretty surreal experience, frankly, to get the assignment to read Modiano, someone I had known and I'd read maybe back in high school, actually, because I work mainly in Francophone context, so outside of France. And then to begin delving into Modiano and reading one after the other, as I'm actually traveling through the spaces that he's writing about was actually kind of extraordinary, I have to say. When I'm there, I'm an African-American woman in my early 40s, and I'm reading sort of the travails and the travels of this man who's dealing with something so far removed from my lived experience. But what was fascinating about it was
that even though the content was somewhat far removed, some of the ethos and the atmosphere and the connection to the places was absolutely what I was experiencing. So there was a connection there despite the biographical distinction between us, I suppose.
So when Modiano won the Nobel Prize last year, everyone said, "Who's that?" and then quickly read up on him, but have subsequently, let's assume, forgotten some of the details. So just as a backgrounder, tell us a little bit about Patrick Modiano.
So Modiano was born, in fact, at the tail end of the Second World War in France to two very colorful characters. One was a Flemish actress and showgirl, and the other was a Jewish black marketeer originally from Thessaloniki, who had settled in Paris. The two of them sort of came together there, had two children, Modiano and his younger brother, who died rather tragically at the age of, I believe, 9 or 10, and promptly sort of forgot about their kids and went on to do their own thing. They didn't like each other very much, his parents, and they didn't particularly enjoy being parents. So Modiano spent his childhood more or less shuttled between different family members, boarding schools, people that they could get to hang out with him for any amount of time. And what's fascinating about this to me is that he sort of has taken, or he took in his writing, this neglect, this indifference from his parents, and used it to really analyze and think deeply about what was the society that created these two people and enabled them to function in the way that they did, which is very much in the shadows, under the radar, in fits and spurts and in little pieces. And in so doing, and trying to sort of piece together the who of what his family was, what he was, and what had happened to him and to them, he really started interrogating France as a nation, France and its history, France and its particular behavior during the Second World War, the war that so much impacted what his life would be, even though he was born at the very end of it.
And why in particular that period of collaboration and occupation? What was it that drew Modiano again and again in his fiction to those subjects?
Well, I think, again, it was twofold. On the one hand, a deep sorrow and regret about the behavior of the people who were closest to him and how that was a reflection of what that time period was doing to people in terms of their morality, their ethics, their willingness to be good people, I suppose. But also, I personally have read in his works, and maybe it's not that difficult to detect, a certain simmering sort of rage against the hypocrisy of what Vichy France was, and maybe even more importantly, what the narrative in France about its wartime collaboration had turned out to be. There's something of a not at all self-righteous, but a true indignation, I think, that Modiano is expressing in these novels that have to do with France's refusal to be accountable to and to acknowledge certain truths, and how that can be entirely frustrating to any human being, much less a human being who feels so deeply traumatized by those half-truths and those fabrications.
You mentioned that his father was Jewish. Was he raised Jewish? Does he think of himself as a Jewish novelist or a French-Jewish novelist?
You know, I wouldn't presume to say with any certainty how Modiano identifies spiritually or religiously or even ethnically. There's no question.
So he doesn't talk about that in his memoir.
Not in the memoir, and he doesn't suggest that his family was practicing in any way. And again, I'm going to say the shocking thing, but some of reading Modiano makes me understand perhaps a not so shocking thing, is in effect that his father is Jewish, or was Jewish rather, but participated and profited from Vichy France.
Right.
While that is this deeply unsettling contradiction, in some ways what both the memoir and the novels lead us to understand is that people can't exist outside of systems, that
right.
There is something coherent and absolute about this particular period in French history.
That question of Jewish collaboration, that was really at the heart of La Place de l'Étoile, The Place of the Star. What was that novel about?
That novel is insane, in a great way. So again, I hadn't read him except for Dimanche d'Outs, August Sundays, to come to him through that first text, La Place de l'Étoile, which is an explosion. I mean, he wrote it in his 20s, and the emotion and the power and the wildness of that particular novel is very different, in fact, from what comes afterward, and is really where he lays out all of his cards, and we see the kernels of the preoccupations we're going to find in the other novels. But in that one, it's a satire, obviously, and it is the story of the crazily named Raphael Shlemelovich. Shlomilovich.
Let's take turns trying to pronounce that.
I'm gonna say Rafael Shlomilovich, and it's the story of this Rafael Shlomilovich, who is an extraordinarily wealthy young dilettante who bounces around Europe, and whose only point. The point of his existence is to have sex with what he calls, Aryan girls, and to write, over-the-top poetry and prose, and to participate in the rhetorical campaign of Vichy France in denouncing Jewishness. And any opportunity he gets to use a racial slur, to use an ethnic slur, to expose his self-loathing, he takes it. And it's really troubling. But Modiano brings you into a space where it starts to seem almost normal, this character. You're bizarrely on his side. You kind of understand his contradictions. And in sort of getting into your head through this intense exaggeration, I think Modiano manages to translate the absurdity of what that situation was in the 1930s and 40s. So
you would say that this book is a satire, and that, I think, makes it a bit different from much of his other work. When people talk about Modiano, they will say that, well, he returns again and again to the same themes. Does that make the novel sort of repetitious, or did you feel like sitting down and reading six of them, they each sort of stood on their own?
Yes, each one of these books could be picked up and read and devoured in a couple of days. They're small, they're thin and dense and compelling. They are each one of them page turners. And to read them all together is to have that experience amplified, meaning I'd finish something and turn immediately to the next mm-hmm. novel to find another way in. Yeah, he could be certainly accused of returning to the same, knot of a story, but he has a different way in each mm-hmm. time, in the same way that any kind of choose-your-own-adventure, any experience of life is all about the angles at which you approach it, right? The choices you make at any different time. Each of these novels makes different choices that open up new worlds.
But he returns to these same themes, and yet you call him a reluctant witness.
It's in the style. He is not effusive. He is not generous in his prose. You get a feeling of compulsion, and I hadn't thought about this before. Yeah, there is something a little compulsive about writing the same book, in a sense, mm-hmm. right, or returning to the same question, in a sense. But there's also a compulsion in the sense of he is compelled to tell these stories,
right,
whether he wants to or not. And that's, I call it in the review, the gritted teethness of his novels, is that the prose tells you what it seems he needs to get out, what he needs to document, the story he needs to be sure someone hears, but it's not gratuitous.
I'm glad that you brought up the language, because one thing that's interesting about these new books is they were translated by a number of different translators. They've come out from different publishers, from Bloomsbury to Yale University Press to Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I think four different translators. How well were these translated? Did any stand out to you in terms of the translation?
I read a couple of them also in French to get a sense. And I was worried about that, frankly, because I'm a translator myself, and I know that you make a choice in your head about the voice of the author, right, of the voice of the story, really. I was impressed at the ability of the translators to adhere to Modiano's voice. I think it's helped by the consistency of his own voice in some ways, and his returning to the story. So there are actually a certain number of phrases that repeat, concepts that reemerge, that I think, any sensible translator must have looked at the other translations to see how their predecessors had dealt with these things. And so there's a consistency to mm-hmm. the translations, and you hear Patrick Modiano throughout.
It must be interesting as a translator yourself to read this literature both in its original language and then in translation. Do you find yourself sort of taking on that role as a reader, thinking, oh, I wouldn't have done it that way, or why didn't you choose this word?
Yes, kind of more though as an intellectual exercise. I was so into the books, I have to say. I mean, I sound like a fangirl, but I was so immersed in the stories that I didn't do a lot of those analytics. Going back over them, perhaps, to do the review, I could see where the French was peeking out, right? You can, as a translator and perhaps as a reader in general, you can see where the translator had to unravel something in a way that shows a little bit of the technique. And so, mm-hmm. yes, that's there, certainly. But I think it's successfully done throughout.
Many of these books will be new to readers, but let's talk about the newest, since one of them is his most recent novel. Tell us about So You Don't Get Lost in the Neighborhood.
This is pedigree fictionalized in some ways.
His memoir.
Yeah. At the core of this story is a writer who is being obliged by some new characters in his life, kind of these people that come into his life out of the blue. He's being obliged to revisit his past, and that past is very similar to Modiano's own past, right? So he revisits a childhood in the post-war moment spent being shuttled between various people. What he adds to the novel, what makes the fiction, is that there's a secret buried in this past. There's a secret, there's a murder buried in this past. And I'm not going to give any spoiler alerts, or I'm giving you a spoiler alert and I won't give you a spoiler.
Good. That's the right way to do it.
There you go, right? But to say that there is a murder mystery at the core of what is also a fictionalized autobiography, I'd say. He gets very close here to putting himself in his fiction, particularly by making the main character a writer in his 60s.
Did you have a favorite?
I mean, it's honestly so hard to distinguish them. I'm tempted to say La Place de l'Étoile. For me, it served as this sort of almost like an index, like a content index to see where he was going to end up going in the rest of his career.
Did you read them chronologically?
I read them in the order they were shipped to me in Europe.
Yeah, there's a little bit of secret sauce revealed here.
Yeah, I started with the trilogy, and then I think I read Pedigree, and then After the Circus, Paris Nocturne, and So You Don't Get Lost in the Neighborhood.
We should confess that we at the Book Review sent Kayama book after book as they kept coming out and coming out and coming out and adding to what was originally a much smaller assignment.
It was really funny to be kind of traveling around with my family. My husband is half German, half French. My kids speak German and French, and we were in France and Germany, and I'm reading these books that have everything to do with France, with Germany, the relationship between the two, as I'm in the space was, you know, going back to what I said earlier, it was surreal and maybe the best possible way to read Modiano.
Well, this is definitely a good moment to read about Paris and France. Mm. And so thank you.
Absolutely.
Kayama Glover reviews this week in the Book Review 7 books by Patrick Modiano. I won't go through all the titles again, but you can read about them in this week's issue of the Book Review. John Williams joins us now as the voice of our listeners and readers and tweeters and Facebook commenters. Hi, John.
Hi, Pamela.
All right. What did you ask this week of our listeners?
Well, it's the end of the year, as we know, and in our Bookends column this weekend, we have all 16 of our Bookends columnists talking about the best book they read this year, old or new. So we asked readers out there for their own picks for the best books they read this year. And so we had a few answers on Twitter. A reader named Stephanie said, Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe, which I thought was a great book title. It's a novel for YA readers by Benjamin Alire Sanz.
Because grown-ups have difficulty understanding those topics?
I believe that the characters in the book are named that, but I didn't do enough investigating.
It's actually a dog and a cat.
Right. David A. Gaspar listed several books, among them Atticus Lish's novel Preparation for the Next Life, Susan Barker's The Incarnations, and Garth Rice Kahlberg's City on Fire, which was one of the year's most covered books, I think. Jeff Christner, also on Twitter, said Rebel Yell by the historian S.C. Gwynne. On Facebook, we had a few answers, too, where we have a page for readers. Sandra Maria, as I said, we asked for books new and old, and she said that she was finally getting around to Salinger's Franny and Zoe, so that's definitely a classic. For a newer book, she liked Tell the Wolves I'm Home by Carol Rifka Brunt. She said that book was like putting my heart and soul through boot camp, only to come out of it stronger than I entered. And then another oldie but goodie, Barbara Hayes said The Moon is Down by John Steinbeck.
Friends of John Williams or Facebook friends of John Williams will know that John himself read 82 books this year. Is it 82 or 86?
Something like that. I don't have the exact count.
Oh, come on.
I don't have the
exact
count. I really don't.
Anyway, of that list, which is now making everyone else feel as bad as I felt when I saw that, what was your favorite book?
I think my favorite book that was old was Mrs. Dalloway, which I finally got around to reading this year, and that's just incredible, as people who have read it know. And then in terms of the new books, our best 10 books, which came out also this week, I read 4 of the 5 fiction books on the list and loved all of them. The one that I liked the most, I think, that didn't get as much attention as those was a comic novel called Man at the Helm by a British writer named Nina Stebe. And it's a very funny novel about two sisters who are trying to find a new husband for their mom. And it just has all that sparkly British wit on pretty much every page.
Did you read her memoir the year before?
I did. I actually read it after I read Man at the Helm. I had heard about it, but I hadn't read it yet.
Because
so I
loved the memoir. So
the memoir is great. It's a series of letters that she wrote to her sister when she was a nanny for a prominent London editor when she was in her 20s. And so she sort of saved those letters and finally published them. And they're also incredibly witty. She's a very funny writer and great company on the page.
Okay. Now I have to ask, is the novel better than the memoir, or do they sort of both on a par?
They're different structurally, but I think the voice is actually similar. If you like the letters because of how witty and fun they are, she brings that really to the novel. I mean, the novel is very energetic page by page, which is great.
Well, it was one of our notables, so.
Yes.
All right. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Pamela.
I am very happy to have James Shapiro here, a Shakespeare scholar from Columbia, to talk about his new book, The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. James, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure.
All right, so tell us about 1606. Why this year? Why this book?
1606 was a very bad year for England. Plague returned with a vengeance. King James's plans to unite Scotland and England and Great Britain fell apart. There was the aftershock of one of the great terrorist attacks in history that didn't happen, the gunpowder plot in November 1605, that spilled over and preoccupied everyone through 1606. So it was just a traumatic year for England, which turned out to be a really good year for Shakespeare, a year in which he finished King Lear, wrote Macbeth, and finished Antony and Cleopatra as well, three great tragedies by year's end.
We've done this sort of year in the life for Shakespeare before with 1599, right? Did you know, okay, next up will be 1606?
I'm sure my publishers wanted me to do 1600, 1601, 1602, or franchise those years to other
right.
writers. They take a long time. 1599 took me 15 years to research and write. This one from when I started, it took me 10 years. So I was a little nervous that I might have chosen the wrong year, or plays like Lear and Macbeth are too daunting. They're Everest-sized plays, and I was worried whether I'd make it even halfway up the mountain.
The people who are outside the realm of Shakespeare scholarship might wonder, what is there new about Shakespeare? How could you, you know, when you talk about research, isn't the research done by now? But there were a lot of archives that opened up, right, in the last 50 years that informed this?
There were things that were discovered in the last 12 months, in the last 12 days of writing this book. Even after I sent it into my publishers, I got a call from archaeologists in London saying, hey, we found in Knowle, in the King's Chambers, this 18-foot-long oak beam that was inscribed with anti-devil markings meant to protect King James, and the wood dates from just when Shakespeare was writing Macbeth. So whoever thinks everything has been discovered has not really had their eyes and ears open.
Do they know that over in England? Like, hey, if something happens during Shakespeare's time, we'll call up James Shapiro in New York and make sure he comes on over. And
you know, amazingly, they do. And it's very exciting. I flew over to England 2 weeks ago just to see this oak beam. And it was thrilling. I mean, there are physical discoveries. And I'm not interested in just ideas. I'm interested in a street-level understanding the perspective of somebody going to the Globe Theater in 1606.
That's interesting because you opened this book with a map. Is it for that very reason to?
It is. I hated Shakespeare in school. I didn't take a Shakespeare course in college. So when I'm writing my books, I'm really thinking of readers who have some resistance to this. This is not their country. This is not their history. It may be a playwright they admire. But I'm convinced that if you understand writers responding to the pressures of that time, you can appreciate the works a bit more.
All right. Where do you start in 1605 and why?
I start with Shakespeare discovering a play that had recently been published and was now for sale in London's bookshops. And it had been published sometime in the summer of 1605. It was an old play called King Lear.
But it's spelled differently.
L-E-I-R. Shakespeare probably knew who wrote it. We don't. It had been around for 15 years, and it's a great story. The original King Lear, that Shakespeare's rewriting, has a happy ending. King Lear gets his throne back. He's reunited with his youngest daughter, Cordelia. So Shakespeare takes this story in late 1605, and he turns it into the darkest tragedy imaginable. All the playgoers thought this was going to be another happy ending play. Instead, Lear dies. We see him enter with his dead daughter in his arms. It's apocalyptic. So Shakespeare was never really interested in creating new stories. He was interested in doing what I think of as gut renovations on old stories. Mm-hmm. And in this one, it was a more profound and darker transformation than anything he had ever done.
Now, looking at the history and what was going on at that time, why? Where did the darkness come from?
Well, King Lear begins with the division of the kingdoms. And there's a political crisis going on as James is trying to combine Scotland and England, and nobody else wants this. James is creating a kind of national identity crisis, and if there's anybody good at exploiting identity crises, it's Shakespeare. And he is able to understand the tensions and the differences circulating at this time and infuse the play with them, a play about the dire consequences either of uniting a kingdom or dividing it.
How does the gunpowder plot fit into this? And tell us, just for those of us who don't know what the gunpowder plot was.
Anybody who's lived through 9/11 has some sense of what it must have felt like in early 1606. A group of 20 disaffected Catholic gentry, disappointed that James had not kept his promises to the Catholics and realizing James was going to live a very long time, decided to roll back the Reformation. They stuffed 36 barrels of gunpowder under the House of Lords and planned to detonate it when King James, the royal family, and the political and religious leadership of England were gathered there. And it was averted at the last moment. As many as 30,000 people, perhaps out of a population of 200,000, would have died. There would have been utter chaos. After the failure of that attack, the surviving plotters raced north to foment the revolution in Shakespeare country. And Shakespeare's neighbors and next-door neighbor was a bagman holding Catholic relics when he was caught as part of this conspiracy. So this hit home for Shakespeare. And it wasn't just a November 2005 event. The entire year was a depressing business of the conspirators rounded up, tortured, publicly tried, brutally executed, and then their Jesuit handlers suffering the same fate.
And there was also at one point a rumor separate that James had been assassinated.
Yeah, it was really, really jumpy. You know, somebody thought that James was assassinated. News raced to Rome, raced to London, not Rome. People were weeping. Parliament was in a panic that they were going to be destroyed again. James rides back to town to great relief. He thought it was because everybody loved him. They were happy for themselves, not for him. So what I try to do is take as many contemporary accounts, letters, documents, poems, plays, including Shakespeare's, and try to recreate what it felt like at this moment, and then try to understand and weave in how Shakespeare's plays, at a time where there's no radio, no newspapers, going to the theater was the place where you tried to understand what your culture was going through at that moment. And Shakespeare was very, very good at explaining.
It's like going on the internet now.
It's going on the internet. It's opening the Times in the morning when you wake up and have that first cup of coffee, except then you went to see Macbeth.
So you're telling really three stories here, right? It's the events of 1605, 1606. It's the ways in which those events directly affected Shakespeare, and then it's the way in which that in turn shaped the work that Shakespeare was doing.
Yes, and it takes a long time to weave those three together into something of great constancy.
And there was probably, I imagine, you know, you kind of have to hold yourself in check not to make too many leaps or assumptions.
You do. You have to back up away from certain claims and test them constantly. I was compared in a recent review to a stone wall builder, and I build stone walls. And putting together a book like this is a lot like building a dry stone wall. The pieces have to lock into place. They have to stand there and survive Frosthaven and everything else. And you just have to be patient, and you have to read deeply, and you have to go to a lot of productions to feel those plays course through you.
Let's talk about like a very concrete way in which you can detect those changes. One is the word God disappears from Shakespeare's plays. Why?
in the middle of 1606, Parliament, frustrated that they couldn't enact a great deal of anti-Catholic legislation, like let's take kids away from Catholics, let's, you know, basically Donald Trump style.
I was going to say, this sounds very contemporary.
It is, and readers will nod in recognition at the overreaction to these religious fanatics who are a fifth column in our nation. There were scandalous plays. There are always scandalous plays. Playwrights are always pushing the edge too far, not Shakespeare, but his rivals. And one of the ways in which Parliament responded to this was to say, okay, we can't control plays. That's not in our power. But we can say that you can't use God's name in vain. That famous beginning of Othello, s'blood or God's blood or s'foot, all the casual oaths that we know were part of this culture could no longer be spoken on stage
it's
by
like
an actor.
The Hays Code for Shakespeare.
Yes. The neatest thing was, though, the way it was enforced was whoever ratted out an actor got half the money for doing so. So if you were an actor in Shakespeare's company and had these plays by heart, you had to stop yourself every time from saying these things. And of course, we now know which plays date from before and after 1606, because if they were printed after, they did not have these words.
So you started off by saying, you know, this was obviously not a happy period in England, but it worked out quite well for Shakespeare. Why?
Shakespeare had been struggling for a few years to find his footing in this new Jacobean regime. Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth, dies in 1603. King James comes to the throne in that year. Shakespeare is writing one play at maybe two at most, where he had been writing three or four in the late Elizabethan years. He had to figure out what was going on, and I think he was a little out of step with the times in the earliest years of the 17th century. But the events of this year really coalesced for him in these three extraordinary tragedies, which form a kind of trilogy.
Before you go, I have to take advantage of having you here in New York right before the Royal Shakespeare Company.
It's going to be a big year. 2016 is the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare. The Royal Shakespeare Company is coming for a month-long residency at BAM. The most exciting thing besides that is a visit of one of the first folios from the Folger Shakespeare Library. And there's going to be an exciting, exciting collaboration between the Public Theater, the 92nd Street Y, and the New York Historical Society all through June into the summer. So it's going to be a great year for Shakespeare in New York.
Looking at this purely from a perspective of opportunity, what plays are performed frequently in the U.S. versus which ones are more rare, which one would you want to see or should viewers take advantage of going to see while they have a chance?
We do see a lot of the Henry IVs and Henry V's in New York City. Richard II is done more rarely. David Tennant, Doctor Who fame, is a brilliant Richard II. I've seen it a couple of times, and I know when it comes to New York, I'm going to see it a few more times myself.
The Doctor Who thing, I think, will probably help a lot. All right, James, thank you so much.
That's my pleasure.
James Shapiro is the author, most recently, of The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606. It's reviewed this week in the Book Review by Jane Smiley. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
We don't have a lot of news, do we?
No, really slim pickings this week as we head into the holidays.
People are just going for like the old dependables?
Yeah. There are three new titles. Two of them, you know, could conceivably be a tie-in to kind of Christmas presents. But mostly, you know, people are either buying what they're used to or buying what they've heard good things about. And so it's all the things that were already on the list.
All the things we cannot see.
The three new books, two of them are on the hardcover fiction list, starting down at number 14. Danielle Steele is back with a book called Precious Gift. So there's your possible Christmas tie-in. Although it's not such a Christmassy book. It's a book about a patriarch who has died and dispersed his estate among his children and former wife.
I think our publishers have established like next year is like the Year of Steel, where they're publishing like an unusual number of Danielle Steel novels.
That's news to me.
Well, it'll be, I imagine, on the best bestseller list next year. Okay.
And then the second new title on the fiction list is all the way up at number 3. Mark Greaney returns. He's the person who, for the end of Tom Clancy's career, co-wrote several of Tom Clancy's books and then picked up the Jack Ryan series once Clancy died in 2013. He's back with a new Jack Ryan book called Tom Clancy, Commander-in-Chief.
Tom Clancy, colon, Commander-in-Chief.
Exactly. I say in the column, you know, despite appearances, it's not a book about bringing Tom Clancy back from the dead to run for president.
All right. What's going on in nonfiction?
Nonfiction, the only new title, also potentially a Christmassy tie-in. It's a book called Gratitude. It's by Oliver Sacks. And what this book does is it gathers all 4 of the op-ed essays that Oliver Sacks wrote for the New York Times after his cancer diagnosis, when he found out in 2013 that he had just a short time to live.
The Times Upshot just did a story online yesterday about our most read stories, and Oliver Sacks's, some of those pieces were among those.
Unsurprisingly.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.